Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about thought strategy I have behind wanting to investigate a medieval thinker, Christian thinker called Nicholas de Cusa. Now, I'll just give you a brief view about who he is, and then we won't talk about him anymore. I'll just talk about sort of the thinking strategies and some of the ideas of why I'm the odd person out of all the various, I suppose, group of colleagues or teaching colleagues. I'm the odd person out looking at this chap. So Nicholas de Cusa is a 15th century or in the, I think from 1401, he died at 63, so 1401 to 1464 is this chap. So that's a fair ripe old age for someone like himself. And he was a prolific thinker, and he was someone on the verge of scientific thinking. He came up with the idea of learned ignorance and sort of a reflection on things. And he was a contradictory character by our standards. He was, one of the things is he was in for capital punishment and repression, but then he was in for, he was just a critical character. He sort of had in front of him really important documents which questioned the legitimacy of his own church, and then he was also in this incredible age of tolerance where he was looking at how to unite the Islamic, the Greek Orthodox and the Christian religion. Sort of you can see that, you go there for certain ways. Then he's also at the very edge, the cusp of what we would see as democracy. He thought that people needed to be represented somehow. A group of people needed to be represented, but it was also critical that they gave their consent to be represented. And so this is sort of, it's just on the boundaries of some of the more modern ideas that we're having. And so he's someone that I want to go back to time and time again. So when you look at the history of science, you dig deeper, and you see he's a critical turning point person. Now, look, the general consensus is someone's walking along, working along, and they say, "Oh, what are you doing?" And say, "Oh, yeah," if they're reading a magazine about the latest motorsports or holidays, and I'm reading a book about Nicholas de Cusa, they'll say, "Oh, what's the importance?" And then they'll say, "Look, you're really crazy. You shouldn't be doing that. You should be focusing on the here and now." And I'll take that on board. Perhaps I should. Do you want to hear about it? No, it's just rubbish. Is he up to date? No, he's medieval. Oh, just forget it. And it sort of comes into bearing in that you get the sort of feeling that you're on some sort of European Kentucky tour. This is with a tour guide, and everyone sees things from perspective. Like you see your monument, a really good monument, but the bus has stopped and you're out there and people are selling you wares, and you're looking at from only a certain perspective. It's sort of like you're walking in a museum, a Madame Tussauds museum. So there's sort of images, and you're in the major group, and it's only lit from your direction that you're looking at. And in your mind, you can actually wander behind there and actually go further back. And there's sort of courses recorded, courses. There's sort of a very convenient, ready, that you are, in fact, the fast food of the, you're the convenience consumer of society. Like, society has got convenience products, and you're a product for society. You're a convenience product. And the most convenient way is to have someone who can solve problems pretty instantly. You want to turn the tap, just call a few people in, and they size up pretty well what to do. And that really gets you in the sort of the short term. You look at the immediate past and the immediate lines leading into your situation, and you look at the immediate problems that you are going to come up and apply resources. And these people arguably are very effective in their way, and but they are tools, and they are the fast food of society. I don't know if that makes sense. They buy fast food, but if you think of a society as an organism, and people as the food that are fed there, people have made themselves into fast food, which they get fed into the system, and so it's they get a calorie high. Designed to meet the market need, and they're full of sugar, and they work really quickly, and they create a dependency. One of the things that people really want in society is that they want to be wanted, and so they make sure that they're very effective, but not so effective that they're not necessary anymore, that there's a continuous contractual agreement, similar to someone who's gorging on fast food. You know, that they get the high, but it doesn't last very long, and they need more and more. They need to be permanent. And so that's a way of view, and I can do it. And you sort of like I'm a bowl of muesli trying to speak to a sugary milk drink or a can of Coke, and we're for different can be used in different ways. And so if you're not looking at the immediate past, how far back could you go? Because there's a lot of volume out there, a lot of volume of information out in the past. And if you're not looking at the immediate future, what are you doing? What strategy could work? So this is what I want to just cover just really briefly here. And I realize that perhaps when I'm speaking to various people, it's, you know, speaking into podcast land, people may say, oh, I don't follow it. So that's all okay. And I look up at the sky, and this beautiful, clear sky. It's absolutely freezing out here, but you can see the beautiful stars up above the Southern Cross and all that type of stuff, getting back into it. So what's the alternative strategy for someone who is, a thinker? Well, it's not necessarily a thinker, but the people struggle to serve themselves up to society, or the need at hand, or the sort of like combination that I imagine people as fast food trying to get up. And the idea is that you don't select to be not eaten, or society selects you not to be eaten. So it is little point of studying your immediate past or your immediate future, because you don't have an immediate future to work with, and the immediate past is going to be pretty irrelevant by the time you get to called up to do something. So if you're like me, you're sort of laid off from the side, and you there's little point in reading, say, the syllabus or the or worrying about the next group of students through. Your mind can say, well, let's analytically look at what is the sweet points, which are the levers in the past that give you fantastic insight looking forward and looking back. And as we'll discover, Nicholas de Cusa is a critical person. He's someone on the dawn of science. You can say, Galileo thought this. Well, you know, you really scratch your head about Galileo being the first experimental scientist. And indeed, Nicholas de Cusa is in a time before experimental observation, but there is certain observations inside it. He's a critical, if you like, a inflection point, sort of a step before an inflection point. So inflection points are really important. It's the steps before which actually bring things up, and they have a way of saying things or doing things which tie all past thinkers, and as we will listen to Nicholas de Cusa, you'll see that he has summoned looked very deeply into the past in an analytical way, which is a break with a methodical, layer upon layer, scholastic tradition, which can't see any perspective, or they can see a perspective, and you're reading into it, but it's half mystical. Like, if you go right back, you can read some of Aristotle, which is okay, but if you read other people either side, it's full of mystical guff. And even though I truly like Thomas Aquinas going in and his methodology, you put things aside. You say, well, here's his choirs of angels. So he's got ranks and choirs, you know, three ranks per choir and three choirs at various stages. Where does it come from? It's sort of quasi mystical, and so this is where the transition from the mystical world, the mystical fascination, goes into the science world. So this is a critical lever person, and I think this is about science. Is that we have to say that science is quasi-mystical. There's a mysticism in science. There's a priesthood in science. There's structures in science which come from religion and come from a super society. So as religion was a society which was a meta-society which went across natural society, the lords and that process, So science is there's parallels in there, and it's hard to see it until you actually go back where science and Christianity sort of parted ways. And he's definitely not parting ways with Christianity. He is definitely a Christian. And as you go forward, Galileo is definitely Christian. He's a pragmatist. But Newton is definitely Christian. Descartes is definitely Christian. They talk about God. They definitely believe about God. And that break is going to come later. And so, and there are these turning point people, I suppose, like Einstein, Planck, people who, it's not the transition people, it's the people who don't quite make the transition, and why they don't quite make the transition. And that's because they're linked to the past in such an intense way that the future, they make a leap to the future, but there's just not enough there yet. It's really intense. So, like, if you're looking at the African struggle, for instance, it's a different topic. For instance, you look at, say, Nelson Mandela. He's a very fantastic person. He's a go-to person to understand the transition to of South Africa has taken, but it's some of the other people who didn't actually quite make the transition, who struggled and failed or limited view. Their limited view is a spotlight. It's got an intense intensity to how it diverges from the past and diverges from the future. Their trajectory is so different that it really gives a view. Now, of course, if you're in the Kon-Tiki Tour view, this is mad, because you have to understand them. You actually got to walk back into the past and look at it, and that gives a huge value. And why is there a value? Well, you walk from that past viewpoint, you can look at the present and see people in the present in this sort of transition where they can't quite make it. I mean, our presence is in that transition. We have people who want democracy and things like that, but they have nuclear weapons. You know, this is sort of bizarre to come across, or we want to do something, but we do something else. It's a very bizarre complexity. So our current age is an age of transition, and so this is why you would want to look back to the age of transition. So I've said why, but they're the sort of deeper thoughts to saying why, and so I have the advantage that I can indulge in doing it, because I'm the health food which has been put off to the side, and everyone else is the fast food being put in, and the fast food is got to have the marketing and the high, the two short terms things going across. I don't know, I'm just mixing a few metaphors in there, trying to bring it across. And again, But this is where Nicholas de Cusa comes along. He unashamedly says, this is too hard, I'm going to use metaphors. And he's got some structures which we don't use nowadays. The moment that you try and explain something with metaphors, to metaphor go across, communications smart people come in and say, okay, well, every metaphor you use represents a fraction of an audience that you're going to lose, because they will take the metaphor literally. They're not trained in metaphors, and so metaphors are out. But perhaps we do need metaphors to get us through this transition, this duality of things. This is, Nicholas de Cusa was attempting things that is unthinkable today in our world, where we have ISIS and the Muslim divide and all these hatred. He was actually thinking through it, and he was thinking through it with these metaphors. So it's these transition people that you look back in history. So it's not necessarily Abraham Lincoln. It's probably another person who, in there, I don't know enough about the history. Oh, look, there are beautiful things. I think there's the I don't know party. These amazing little sub parties which survived, flourished, and died, and it's the way that they rose and fell so quickly. It tells you so much information. It's the view that we want to look at the past as the sustainable threads, because it's only relevant to what we are doing at the moment. Well, that may be so, but it is basically looking at the past with the prejudice of your present going forward. So that's enough of the past and why I want to look at Nicholas de Cusa and my strategy there. And look, my overall strategy here is that what I do is I just look at a topic, think about a topic. In the background of my head, say, look, I'm going to do a podcast, no more, it's going to do in so many minutes' time, it just goes, and then I go through, and at the back of my brain, I say, I'm really confused on this point, I might look it up or not, and then I go. Now, Nicholas de Cusa, I've given you my quick synopsis of it, and the synopsis of it is not, I haven't arrayed the information in my head ready for communication, I've arrayed it ready for the linkages with the philosophers, and it links ancient philosophy through Christianity into the modern science. It's a fantastic viewpoint. It's something that when you're looking at it, you're going, you don't go, aha, I'd like to tell my mates at the barbecue about Nicholas de Cusa. You just find yourself standing by yourself. You never think of communicating it, and so I've never structured it there, and so this is why when I looked at a fairly exhaustive communication structure which is a 40-page large print document by Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophers, I've said, you know what, that's actually got a structure, and it serves the points of cardiac rehabilitation, brain rehabilitation. Now we know a little bit more of why I was been really knocked about mentally and having trouble memorizing things or remembering things, and there's maths I could do before, I can't do it now, but there's other maths I can do. It's sort of really crazy. So it's part of cardiac rehab and producing upper head and filling up to the sensible sort of maximum, so I can understand my podcast automation to the full. I'm just going to read this Stanford process, the Stanford book, because what actually happens is that when you go through something and you explain it, you realize halfway through, just at the back of your head, you say, I wish I could have said that earlier on. It would make the story a much more linear story. It's not that this 40 pages is going to be very linear. It's several pages of boring reading, but it's probably better than actually reading the really poorly constructed New South Wales curriculum, science curriculum. I must admit, when I read that, and I was reading the same sentences again, which were copied and pasted from one page to the other with slight variation, or I was reading an icon, the description of the meaning of a particular icon, and then you go through and the icon is never used in the syllabus. Like, there's no Aboriginal stuff in the syllabus whatsoever. And so they've done token lip service by saying, here's the definition of this icon, but we don't use it. There's all these contradictions here. That's because it's a working committee document for a functional thing. It's like reading the manual for your little your toaster. Your toaster will tell you, here's the warranty situations and tell you how to avoid, I don't know, a manual will repeat itself. So I think reading this old 40 pages from Stanford Encyclopedia is a good solution. And as I read through it, I'm sure I will crash and burn and realize it. But then there's a sort of wholeness. It's a communication about a topic. So that's in the past. Okay, so there's, as to the analogy, we're in a group tour. We're in a Contiki tour. We've got to earn our money, get in a group, work effectively as a team, and produce. And we are labourers, and we sell ourselves as a product, and we market ourselves, market our ideas, and we market what we'll do as a sugar high. So as a high, there's a convergence to not do what we're doing, is to dig back and look at the oddballs. However, the view is that the oddball transitions things that there are recently is they actually develop the tools, the metaphorical tools, the actual thinking tools, or the linkages that are certain valuable now. Now, that's done in the past. We're looking at the future a bit. So a lot of people are looking at the strategy which will produce a result in the short term. And you can say, well that's that is applying what is a known answer to produce a known solution to produce a product coming out. And essentially, that's a step away from research, where research has, as almost Nicholas de Cusa coined, learned ignorance. But he meant something different. But it's a feeling of, I am ignorant of all the actual mechanisms and the game theory and the game play coming across ahead. And I need a general strategy and a general target, which has got a probability of failure, but a probability of finding out more information or developing things that when I go in that direction, I'll be able to move forward. So that's a fundamental thing from, I suppose, what I could be doing is I could be going through the various websites at the moment looking for other teaching jobs where I wouldn't have half the hassle of all these unthinkable, tractable things. But that actually doesn't solve the fundamental people problem of why we're trying to educate people, bring them forward, yet the actual naive knowledge and people-centered approach is not on the menu. There's got to be other less results. So you could sort of get and say, look, I should really focus on that. Yet it so happens that the general so there's sort of again with research a bit of intuition about the unknown. So if you go all these months back, I've said, oh, look, I'm not there yet. I don't quite understand what's going on, but I'm going to have to really push myself, drag myself to rebuild it. And then many months down the track, they sort of neurologists come in and say, oh, look, yeah, there's these definite deficits coming in, and you've definitely had, it's a smoking gun. We'll find out for sure. Now, if I hadn't had that research thing of there's no direct opportunity for me to go out and engage and work, if I didn't have that long range view, so And so that sort of couples together in terms of the long-range view means that you will start to do unusual things, like sort of set an unrealistically high podcast target for yourself, or say, well, what are we going to bring forward? What are some of the elements I'm going to bring forward? One of the things I'm really struggling to do is, having understood quantum physics, trying to communicate that. That's one aspect. Or having understood that there are these key transition people, these key philosophers, bring them forward, but not in a linear story way, but, or in this case, I'm going to read it through in a long time in a linear story way, but to bring it into play. So I'm over the horizon with a emergent toolkit. So look, there's lots of philosophers that you want to get in. I think there's Epicurus. What a fantastic philosopher. He was to enjoy life for the moment, and he was a many worlds person. Look, there are so many, many, many worlds people. It just kills me that many worlds is being abused in the current thing. And he had a way of just mind over matter, and so he died in excruciating agony from a kidney stone and gout, and of course he was, and that's the philosophy there. So he's an interesting person. Is he very successful? Yes, he is successful. There's the fundamental Epicurean undercurrent of modern capitalism. However, you could actually make people self-aware of what they're doing, or they would stop buying as much as stuff like that. There's Philo, the philosopher, and he's a fantastic philosopher to come across. Another transition philosopher. He's in at the time of Christ. So Christ himself, that time, he is a transition figure. He is a transition figure from the ancient order to a modern order, which evolved and was set right to evolve to produce this incredibly powerful thing of Christianity as just like the biggest mind thing. So Christ is interesting, but Philo, who's also a philosopher at the time of Christ, is such a pragmatic, beautiful philosopher. And amazingly, he went to the Holy Land in Jerusalem at the time of Christ, and wrote down a lot of detail, but missed the Christ thing. So it sort of shows the focus. It's one of those ways. It's sort of like we've got one view of Christ and the Holy Land. Able to actually move back and actually look at some of the structures and the things that these people were looking at. Then you can look sideways and see what he didn't see. That's a really, really interesting thing. And, of course, Nicholas de Cusa, Giles of Rome. Giles of Rome, he's such a practical, hard-working, lost soul, and he's sort of stumbled across the concept of mass. You've got all these things. Faraday, an amazing individual, an amazing story, but no one knows it, and no one wants to know it, because it contradicts the heroic view of science. Scientists, yet scientists are modelled on this man. It says as much about the time as our ability. Like, you really have to, for everything that you understand that in your age that you're in, that this is not understood, and it's extremely, extremely profound theme. So, and this is the podcasting, the maths, the algorithms and things like this are for over the horizon stuff. Perhaps things will come together, but they won't come together unless I've got a body of podcast work, unless I've got the actual structures there, I've got the actual things beginning to set up, and it won't come easily. So the first time, it's taken a long while to go. But this is mind-blowing stuff, because for your fast food, you're a muesli serve them usually next to a couple of fast, easy to eat hamburgers, sweets, but you know, the people are going to rush and take it, and you're actually working out a strategy for getting beyond the next meal. Your time constant is a long time constant. In terms of the nutrition that you add to the society or whatever it is, your nutrition is a long, long game, time game. So this is why looking at it there, you look into the past under a particular movement, and you're not looking at the past to recount or tell anybody or teach anyone. You're looking for the past for the analytical juice, which will allow you to process what's happening now and also develop the long-term goal. And can I say what the research, what this process will produce? I don't think. I think on one aspect, yes, it has to work. On the other aspect, I acknowledge that it must never work. And it doesn't worry me, in that there are people running around who've made a decision that it must never, ever succeed, no matter what. And what it is well that's sort of the typical transition environment that you work in, that the people in the past have worked in, and I'm working in at the moment, this thing of a reality that it's not going that way. And of course, that's if you look at any point in history, you'd poll a lot of people, and the majority of them would vote against the future that they actually do exist in. And I don't know, it's really hard way to go. Looking at the past gives you resilience for the present, and gives you some sort of idea of the toolkit that you need for the future. So that's what I'm going to go and get for. Sorry if I can well imagine some confused people listening to it. You may understand it, but that's a genuine deconstruction of the sort of the core strategy running around at this moment. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.